in the first part of our examination of same-sex behavior in the Bible, last week, we noted how there are three different types of texts in the Hebrew Bible. There's prose, there's poetry, and there's law. We also saw how in the Hebrew Bible there are two stories, one in Genesis and the other in Judges, that some people have thought had to do with same-sex behavior. There's the story of Sodom in Genesis 19 and a parallel story in Judges 19. We also took a look at a bit of poetry where David speaks a poetic lament for his friend Jonathan, saying that his love was wonderful, surpassing that of women. We noted how some scholars think the relationship between Jonathan and David had an erotic element to it, but other scholars question this. So now, if you didn't get last week's, like I said before, you can listen to it on my website. And if you email me and you prefer to read something, I'm certainly willing to just send my text to you so you can read it if you prefer that to listening. So now tonight we turn to the law in the Hebrew Bible. There's two legal texts from the Hebrew Bible that are often cited in contemporary discussions of same-sex behavior. Both of these texts come from the book of Leviticus. Now, to give you an idea of how tricky the wording of these texts is in Hebrew, I'm going to quote from Richard Elliot Friedman's translation of Leviticus 18:22 and 20:13. It's a little more literal. This is his translation. "You shall not lay a male the layings of a woman. It is an offensive thing." That's 18:22. Now 20:13. "And a man who will lay a male the layings of a woman, the two of them have done an offensive thing. They shall be put to death. Their blood is on them." So, some interpreters have tried to suggest that these texts only prohibit some, but not all, same-sex acts. But it seems to many scholars, including Richard Elliot Friedman, who, you know, my comments on the Hebrew texts that we're looking at are, what I'm sharing with you largely comes from him. He was my professor many, many years ago at the University of California, San Diego. I didn't learn this from him then. I learned it subsequently from one of his books that's listed in the suggested reading. So last week we looked at some things he had to say, and this week we're going to consider some more things he has to say about these texts. So there's many scholars like Friedman for whom they agree this is a direct prohibition of all same-sex acts. Friedman would agree with that. But even scholars like Friedman note that these texts in Leviticus raise at least three questions. Question number one, why does the law prohibit male same-sex behavior and not female? That's the first one. Second, what is the reason for prohibiting it? And thirdly, can this law change or is it an eternal prohibition that can never be different? Three important questions. So that's what I want to try to tackle one by one. So first, why does the law prohibit male same-sex acts and not female? Again, I'm sorry to have to get explicit, but this is one of those conversations where it can't be avoided. And anyway, where the Bible's explicit, we shouldn't be too squeamish to talk about these things as adults. I mean, we're mostly talking about texts that don't get into children's Bibles, don't get into Sunday school, and that sort of thing, but we're all adults here. So,
we're all sinners here.
And
that's the best part.
Yeah. So here we go. Some scholars think that the answer to why it deals only with male same-sex behavior, not female, has to do with a concern for wasting a man's seed. In other words, in male same-sex acts, the man's semen does not produce children. Pretty evident fact. But in this text, there's no reference to seed whatsoever. Furthermore, there's no prohibition in the Hebrew Bible against other things that actually waste semen. For example, sex with a pregnant woman, sex after menopause, masturbation, sexual acts between a man and a woman that do not involve vaginal intercourse, and birth control of various sorts. We know that spilling seed is not what bothered the authors of these laws in Leviticus, because there is a specific law dealing with that in Leviticus 15, 16 through 18. Another answer some scholars give for there being no mention of female same-sex acts here is that they say women were sufficiently controlled in that culture so that this wasn't an issue. But that doesn't really make sense, because in the very next verse in Leviticus, and we've always got to look in context, there's a law against sex with an animal, and it's applied to men and women. Fact is, even in very restrictive societies, and certainly we're learning about this through our global communication that goes on today, even in very restrictive societies, same-sex behavior exists, despite the claims of the, who was it, the president of Iran said we don't have this here. Well, I wonder about that. Even in restrictive societies, it's there. And Dr. Friedman's comment on this is sort of a self-evident statement. This is because the sex drive is a powerful thing. I think we could all agree on that. So that's why even in restrictive societies, you see this sort of thing going on. Some people say that the law against female same-sex practice is implicit in these verses in Leviticus. But that's a huge interpretive leap when there's no mention of women in these texts whatsoever. We shouldn't draw a conclusion on an important life issue based upon a possible secondary implication of a verse. That's especially true in this case, where women are explicitly mentioned in the very next verse. So, others say, well, these male authors of Leviticus simply were not interested in, nor did they have knowledge of female sex. But again, that's a stab in the dark. We don't know. Friedman, on the other hand, he thinks the reason Leviticus does not prohibit female same-sex acts, and I think his suggestion is intriguing, is because of polygamy. So let's think through this for a minute. In Israel, in biblical times, men could have many wives and concubines. I think we all know that. In these circumstances, there was certainly opportunity for group sex and voyeurism. Given this fact, it's perhaps understandable why men did not forbid female-to-female sexual contact. And I know what you're probably thinking. But God gave these laws to Israel. Okay, that may be so. That's probably how some of us look at these texts. Maybe not all of us. Okay, but these laws still, even if we consider them God-given and inerrant, they still favored a man's role in marriage. They allowed polygamy in the first place, making female-to-female sexual contact not only possible, but quite likely. Just a few verses later, Leviticus 18:18, the law forbids a man from having sexual relations with two sisters at the same time. But there's no prohibition against having sexual relations with two unrelated women at the same time. It's just not there. So whatever the reason may be, female same-sex behavior is not forbidden in the Hebrew Bible. Now this fact tells us something very important, if we're willing to think about it. It tells us that it was not something about same-sex behavior in and of itself that was the issue for the writer or writers of Leviticus. Rather, their objection had to do with something about male-to-male sexual contact. That's the focus of their concern. Now, Friedman asks, well, who's bothered by male-to-male sexual contact, but not female-to-female sexual contact? Well, I think we know this is true of many men. What is it that bothered them in the time of the writing of Leviticus? Well, we've already seen that they were not concerned about the waste of seed. You might respond by saying, but Genesis says be fruitful and multiply. Yes, it does. But that's presented in Genesis as a blessing from God, not a requirement of each and every human being. We read, and God blessed them and said. Now, of course, Israel, as a tiny nation amidst much larger and more powerful nations, was certainly concerned with population growth. But obviously, humans down through history have been fruitful and have multiplied and filled the earth far more than they ever did in biblical times without every person on the earth producing offspring, right? Other people think that this command against male-to-male sexual contact has to do with the Israelite concern with keeping things distinct, which we see that concern reflected in Leviticus. But that argument doesn't make sense because it's in heterosexual sex that male and female are mixed, right? And if there's a concern here for men not to act like women and women not to act like men, then why is there no commandment against female-to-female sexual contact? Plus, it just doesn't seem to jive with human experience. As Friedman notes, people usually oppose same-sex behavior, and I'm quoting here from him, for cultural and personal reasons, for gut-level psychological reasons, sometimes for reasons of power, fear, control, acceptance in a group, having someone on whom to look down, instinctive abhorrence that they themselves cannot necessarily explain, reasons of which we may approve or disapprove. And if you don't think that's so, we don't have to think too far back. We only have to go back to the Second World War and the Nazis, and many homosexuals went to the gas chambers along with the Jews. We need to keep that in mind. Some people say that same-sex behavior is immoral. I imagine we have people here tonight who would look at this that way, and I understand that. But there's a question we have to ask. Exactly what is it that's immoral about it? It's important to understand that. Why? Well, in the case of murder, theft, false witness, we can see in each of those situations how those harm other people. We can see what's wrong and what the problem is with sex between adults and children. But in the case of same-sex behavior between two consenting adults, it's hard to see what the harm is, especially if, in today's terms, they're practicing safe sex. And let's add to that, okay, what if they're monogamous? Okay, imagine that situation, and then you ask, what's immoral about it? I don't think the answer is quite as clear. I know some people will say, but same-sex behavior is immoral because the Bible forbids it. Okay, but that's begging the question. Because the original question was, what was immoral about same-sex behavior? Okay, so to say it's immoral because the Bible says is, you know, you're reasoning in a circle there. So the fact of the matter is the Hebrew Bible never answers this question. It doesn't tell us what's immoral about it. Leviticus simply says that male-to-male sexual contact is toiba, an abomination. Now it's important to understand that an abomination is not actually or necessarily something immoral, as we would think of that term today. It's simply something that offends someone. Okay? And that's one way to translate that word, as it's offensive. Okay? Now, here's the really striking thing about this law against male-to-male sexual contact. It appears in this, only in this one strand of the law. You see, as scholars have studied the Old Testament law, they found there's at least four separate authors of biblical law in the Hebrew Scriptures who are writing over a period of centuries. This law against male-to-male sexual contact, it's in the latest strand. The other three strands of the law, just in case you want to look them up when you go home, are the Covenant Code in Exodus 21 to 23, the Decalogue, that is the Ten Commandments or a treatment of them in Exodus 34, 14 to 26, and then there's the Deuteronomic Law Code in Deuteronomy 12 through 26. None of these contains any law about same-sex behavior. None of these other strands. The law prohibiting male-to-male sexual contact is part of the priestly laws, and in particular, the section of these laws known as the Holiness Code, which is contained in Leviticus 17 to 25. Some scholars trace this code to a different author or even a different group from the rest of the priestly laws. According to Friedman, these laws come from an Aaronid priest, okay, that's somebody descended from the line of Aaron, in ancient Judah, and it's the latest of the major law codes. Here's what he says about it. We cannot say why the other law codes do not mention homosexuality. All we can say is that it does not appear to be a concern in biblical law until a fairly late stage. And therefore, we cannot know how people in biblical society overall regarded homosexuality. We only know that this one author in this one community stated that it was an offensive thing. So here's the big question. Why does only this author of the Holiness Code raise the matter of male-to-male sexual contact? How does the Holiness Code differ from other law codes in the Bible? Well, Friedman notes these things about it. Number one, the other law codes are written earlier. Number two, they don't deal with sex very much at all. Number three, the Holiness Code comes from the Jerusalem priesthood. Number four, the Jerusalem priesthood was closer to the monarchy, favorable to it, intermarried with it. And number five, the priestly laws in general in this section called the Holiness Code in particular are concerned with purity. And this law about male-to-male sexual contact is a matter of purity to these priests. As we quoted above in Leviticus, purity is placed alongside holiness in importance to the priests. Quote, to distinguish between the holy and the secular and between the impure and the pure. Now here's a question to think about, one to which I don't have a complete answer. Is it possible that the writers of the Holiness Code were objecting to male, same-sex prostitution that perhaps took place in relation to the temple in Jerusalem? Now that may sound weird to you, but there's actually a suggestion in the Bible that this was going on. This is certainly possible that that's what the author of Leviticus is dealing with. Because the scriptures talk about male prostitutes in Israel in Deuteronomy 23:18, 1 Kings 14:24, 1 Kings 15:12, 1 Kings 22:46, and 2 Kings 23:7. In fact, here's what 1 Kings 14:24 says. See if it has a familiar ring to you. There were also male temple prostitutes in the land. They committed all the abominations of the nations that the Lord drove out before the people of Israel. So at least in this one verse outside of Leviticus, male temple prostitutes are connected with abominations. But, on the other hand, we don't know for sure whether these male temple prostitutes had sex only with women or women and men. We don't know. So when you come right down to it, we do not know why male-to-male sexual contact was objectionable to those who wrote the Holiness Code, because they do not tell us why. Now, I can imagine before we get to it tonight, the discussion, and everybody's free to say whatever they want. I'm sure we probably all could come up with our theories about why this is, forbidden in Leviticus. But all of them would be just that. They'd be theories, because we're not actually told why. We actually know more about same-sex behavior in other ancient cultures than we do about its place in Israel. And here's what Friedman writes about it, kind of a good summary. In ancient cultures of the biblical region, we find a particularly different way of seeing homosexuality than the way in which we tend to understand the category today in the West. Historical texts from the ancient Hittites, Babylonians, Assyrians, Egyptians, and Greeks describe legal and cultural boundaries pertaining to male homosexuality. And male homosexual intercourse is actually depicted in art from Uruk, Asher, Babylon, and Susa from as early as the 3rd millennium BCE. But none of these ancient cultures of the biblical region understood homosexuality as a lifestyle choice or as a marker of identity. None of them referred to people as homosexual in opposition to heterosexual, and none of them condemned homosexual behavior categorically. So while historical texts attest to the experience of homosexual desire throughout human existence, the interpretation of this desire and of same-sex activities varies considerably from culture to culture. What this means is that when we think about homosexuality and when we read about homosexuality in an ancient text like the Bible, we need to understand what connotations and interpretations that concept might have brought out in people in ancient Israel. In other words, how did they think about it? Before we can think about how to apply the Bible, the biblical perspective on homosexuality to current issues. And that's a challenge, no matter what issue you're dealing with in the Bible. And that's the question that's always important to ask. What did it mean to them then, before I try to figure out what does God want me to do about this today? So we've reached... First, what can we conclude when we compare these other cultures and attitudes toward male homosexuality in Leviticus? Friedman comes up with this conclusion. He says, what the authors of Leviticus 18 and 20 may be prohibiting is not homosexuality as we would construe the category today, but rather an act that they understood to rob another man of his social status by feminizing him. This particularly makes sense in the context of the greater legislative text in which Leviticus 18 and 20 are embedded, the Holiness Code. So we've reached at least a partial answer to two questions that we raised at the beginning. Why does Leviticus prohibit male same-sex acts and not female? The answer may have to do with the sexual situations introduced by the existence of polygamy. Secondly, why is male-to-male sexual contact prohibited? The Hebrew Bible doesn't tell us. But there was this concern in ancient cultures for the idea that a male-to-male sex act could rob the so-called passive partner of his social status by feminizing him. Then we come to the final question. Can this law change, or is it absolute? Friedman says the answer may be found in the meaning and use of the word toiba, abomination. Is it an absolute or a relative term? Well, when you examine the Hebrew Bible and the way it uses this term, we find it's actually relative. Let me give you a couple examples. Later in Genesis, Joseph tells his brothers that shepherds are offensive. Remember when all of his brothers come down to Egypt because there's the famine, and he's been there for a while, and he's in charge, and so he wants to explain to them how to get along with the Egyptians. He tells them shepherds are offensive. In fact, they are an abomination to the Egyptians. But shepherds are certainly not an abomination to the children of Israel, are they? Because many of them are shepherds. Second example, marrying one sister is prohibited in Leviticus 18:9. Also in this holiness code. It's called an abomination. But Abraham marries his half-sister earlier in Genesis, and it's not an abomination there. Okay? So it's allowed early, it becomes an abomination later. Only point is, the term is used relatively. But what if something is an abomination in the eyes of God? I'm sure anybody who's read through the Bible, you've come across that expression. Is that not something that is an abomination for all times? Maybe. The Hebrew Bible does use the term abomination to God. But the interesting thing is that it doesn't use this term in reference to same-sex behavior. And so Friedman concludes, if this is right, it's an amazing irony. Calling male homosexual acts a toiba was precisely what made the biblical text seem so absolutely anti-homosexual and without the possibility of change. But it is precisely the fact of toiba that opens the possibility of the law's change. So, whatever position one takes on this matter, Friedman says, left or right, conservative or liberal, one should acknowledge that the law really does forbid homosexual sex between males, but not between females. And one should recognize that the biblical prohibition is not one that is eternal and unchanging. The prohibition in the Bible applies only so long as male homosexual acts are perceived to be offensive. This will depend, he says, on further presentation of evidence and arguments about whether it's inborn or not, whether it's properly regarded as psychologically healthy or unhealthy, and whether most people in a community are or are not, in fact, offended by it. Those arguments, he says, are for specialists in biology, psychology, and culture. They are beyond our range of expertise as Bible scholars. Our task here has been to make the biblical evidence known. People are free to deal with this evidence in a variety of ways. And as I pointed out last week, Friedman's one of the foremost Hebrew scholars in the world today. He adds a little bit to this in his commentary on the Torah, which, if you want to read a Jewish commentary on the Torah, I really recommend this one. He goes verse by verse. He gives you the text in his English translation. He gives you the Hebrew, and then he gives extensive notes down below. He says this, in the present state of knowledge concerning homosexuality, it is difficult to justify its prohibition in the Torah. All the movements in Judaism and other religions are currently contending with this issue. His book was published in 2003. Its resolution ultimately must lie in the law of Deuteronomy that states that, for difficult matters of the law, people must turn to the authorities of their age, to those who are competent to judge, and those judges must decide. Deuteronomy 17, 8 and 9. Then he says, in my own view, the present understanding of the nature of homosexuality indicates that it's not an offensive thing, also translated abomination, as described in this verse. The Hebrew term for offensive thing, toiba, is understood to be a relative term which varies according to human perceptions. In light of the evidence at present, homosexuality cannot be said to be unnatural, nor is it an illness. Its prohibition in this verse explicitly applies only so long as it is properly perceived to be offensive. And therefore, he says, the current state of the evidence suggests that the period in which this commandment was binding has come to an end. So what, you may ask, does the Hebrew Bible teach us should be our attitude toward same-sex marriage? It's a slightly different question, but the one we're all trying to answer in this whole process. Well, Friedman answers that question this way. He says, homosexual marriage is a current issue, and it's a step further than the question of attitudes toward homosexuality itself. It also brings female homosexuality back into the discussion, because even though the biblical law does not prohibit female-female sex, the matter of two women marrying one another introduces an additional question about the nature of marriage. The most direct answer, he says, to questions about homosexual marriage in terms of the Bible would be to say that the Hebrew Bible does not address the matter. The laws in the Torah, in fact, hardly address any matters of getting married at all. There's not even anything about the wedding ceremony. Now, he says, some who oppose gay marriage would say that the Bible's conception of the way marriage is supposed to be is a union of a man and a woman. Genesis 2:24 is cited in this regard. There it recounts how the first woman is brought to the first man, who finds her to be a mate, and the text concludes, on account of this, a man leaves his father and mother and cleaves to his woman, and they become one flesh. But then he notes this. This text is not a commandment, nor is it a definition. It's part of a two-chapter section of the Bible that contains stories of the origins of things. That's what the word Genesis means, right? These, he says, are called etiologies. And he explains what an etiology is. It contains the etiology of why people wear clothes, why snakes do not have legs, why women have pain in labor, why roses have thorns, and why men work. This verse 2 is an etiology telling a story of why men and women mate. It has no bearing on whether humans might have homosexual mates as well. It also does not prevent a man from having multiple wives. This was permissible in the biblical world, but this verse in Genesis does not address that matter one way or the other. Indeed, he says, since most Jews and Christians have given up polygamy, this suggests that they don't feel bound by the Hebrew Bible's conception of marriage. Since the Bible does not address homosexual marriage in its laws, its stories, or its poetry, Friedman says, we advise much caution in basing one's views on either side of this question on the Bible. Other kinds of arguments are likely to be more productive.